In the Capitol press room today, two gentlemen from the Michigan Catholic Conference, Tom Hixon and Dave Baluchnik. Gentlemen, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks for having us.
What are the top priorities for 2015 for the Michigan Catholic Conference?
That's a good question. I think for the sake of your listeners, maybe take a step back and better understand who Michigan Catholic Conference is. We're a statewide public policy organization. We speak to public policy issues on behalf of the Catholic bishops in the state. And we have a board of directors that's comprised of 14 individuals, the seven diocesan bishops plus five laypersons, a religious sister, and a diocesan priest. And we act as the official public policy voice of the Catholic Church in Michigan. So we have important policies going forward for the 2015-2016 legislative session. Right now, what's going on in the Michigan legislature related to the state budget is a conversation that is of significance. We've taken note of the proposed merger between the Department of Community Health and the Department of Human Services. Every 2 years, Michigan Catholic Conference takes a look at what those policies that are put forward by the governor and the legislature. Our primary concern being making sure that there is adequate funding for policies that benefit the poor and vulnerable population of the state. So with those two departments, DCH and DHS, merging, the two departments being most responsible for caring for destitute persons in the state, we want to make sure that the funding levels are there to ensure people receive necessary state services if they are low-income individuals, and especially for families and children.
Is there anything that sends up any red flags when you take this? Is we're talking about community health and human services that are now going to be one. Like they have that in Washington, but does that trigger potential policy changes over and above the money issue? There's also policy decisions made, and when it's all under one umbrella, is there any possibility of issues that could arise?
Well, there certainly are. You're talking about, you know, two of the largest state departments we have in Michigan, Rob, and I believe the last count I heard was that represents about 42% of the state budget if they were to be combined. Certainly you have, you know, one director that's the director of community health, and he's acting director for human services, and so hopefully you can get some continuity there. One of the things that we like most about the proposal is that you're looking at the concept of treating the whole human person. For instance, you can look across the state, and I think there are between 20, 25, maybe even 30 different programs that someone could become eligible for. That means 25 different programs that somebody has to go and get approved for or go through that process for eligibility. Why can't one person do the intake and see what every individual would qualify for and get to the root cause of poverty and really find out what is it in this person's life can be taken care of, and what is it in this person's life can we target to maybe lift somebody out of poverty? That's the biggest goal we see with this merger of these departments, is can this be a positive to not just keep people bouncing around in poverty from program to program and going down Michigan Avenue and over to Oakland Avenue and different offices, but rather you know, finding out what is actually going to lift them out of poverty to have a prosperous life and successful life for their families.
With two departments, you've got a situation where one hand doesn't know what the other hand's doing?
I think those two departments work well together on some things, but certainly when you have bureaucracies that are that large and not under the same leadership, you can have that where they don't. One hand doesn't know what the other one's doing.
Other things that are going to come up this year. Let's start with the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. It surfaced late last year. Dave, you made reference to some things that happened late in the year. First of all, let's explain what that is. Let's start with that first.
Well, if we take a look back to what Congress passed in 1993, it was a Religious Freedom Restoration Act at the federal level. It was a major priority for President Clinton. It was sponsored by Senator Chuck Schumer from New York. It passed the U.S. House of Representatives unanimously in the Senate. It came out of the Senate on a 97-3 vote. And so the proposal that was floated last year in the lame duck session was an exact replica of what's been in place at the federal level for around 20 years or so. And this is a policy that helps to make sure that an individual's First Amendment right to religious liberty is not usurped in any way. and to ensure that the government does not restrict a person's right to religious liberty. And that's a policy that's been also passed in 19 states because the U.S. Supreme Court, which on two separate occasions has upheld the policy as constitutional. Yet in 1997, they also ruled that the policy does not apply to the states. So since that date, 19 states have gone on to pass a state Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And there was a large support in the Michigan legislature to take a look at that last year. And unfortunately, it ran up against the clock. The session expired before there was an ability to actually get to the bill. So it's been reintroduced this year by Senator Mike Shirkey over in the Senate as Senate Bill 4. We don't know what the timing is, what the Senate wants to do on it. If and when they do take a look at it, that is something that's of interest to us and other religious organizations in the state. We believe it's a policy that primarily benefits minority religions to make sure that there is a strong level of diversity in the country when it comes to protecting religious minorities. And one of the examples that I'll give is recently in upstate New York, there was a Sikh person who was looking to join the ROTC at Hofstra University, and he was not allowed to because of he had a beard, which is something that his Sikh religion feels very strongly about. He didn't want to shave his beard. He thought that he could serve his country while still having facial hair and having the United States government recognize his religious liberty rights. So the ACLU, which was a strong supporter of the 1993 federal RFRA, successfully defended this person using the RFRA law that's in statute in New York to allow him to exercise his religious beliefs while at the same time still serving his country.
The law, though, as proposed, gets outside of just the church or church organizations or in this case with federal government, really. It gets into the private sector as well. That's where some people have raised issues, because especially in certain areas of the state where there are a few options sometimes for certain services, could somebody be kept from being provided a service because the owner of a company or something has a religious objection? And isn't there a potential problem there?
Well, there's a lot of misinformation out there about this legislation, and a lot of that really surfaced at the end of last legislative session. You take a look at a situation in New Mexico where there was a woman who did not want to photograph a ceremony between two persons of the same gender, and they have a Religious Freedom Restoration Act in that state, and that was the statute that she used to defend her action. She lost all the way through the court system. There were 12 different judges that took a look at her case, and they all ruled against her. The judges were very clear in that they feel that there is a compelling interest from the government to prevent discrimination, and which is why they sided with against that woman going forward. So a lot of the concerns that have taken place regarding this issue, I think, have been misplaced. What's important going forward is making sure that people's First Amendment rights to religious liberty are protected. And the government has said along the way that they don't believe that it can be exercised in terms of discrimination. The government has a compelling reason to prevent it, and they exercised it as such in the state of New Mexico. So I think that's something that's important to discuss as well.
Dave, if I can add to that, I think it's also important to recognize that this legislation is different from the one that was proposed in Arizona, which would allow for private actors to get involved with one another or not get involved with one another. This is primarily aimed toward government action toward people. So if you have a governmental policy, for instance, one example I like to use, Dave, you had a good example there about at Hofstra University, but there are a couple of examples out there of city ordinances prohibiting feeding homeless people. And you have churches that have a mission to help the poor, and in particular in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, you had an example of a pastor and a very elderly parishioner wanting to help feed homeless in a park, and they were arrested for that. But that wasn't a private-to-private. That was really a situation because the government of Fort Lauderdale, Florida, put an ordinance that said you can't conduct something such as feeding the homeless, which in turn this religion or this parish decided that was part of their mission, and it was infringing upon their religious ministry to help poor people.
I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know much about court precedents, but with the federal RFRA, has there a history with – The definition of sincerely held religious beliefs, has that ever come up as a challenge or anything like that? Because you put a phrase in a law, then it's prone to be challenged. Okay.
That's come forward, and there's been some silly examples where people try to cite their religious beliefs to justify their illegal action. I remember there was a case where somebody got pulled over, and I think they had marijuana on them, and they claimed to be from the Rastafarian religion, and the person obviously wasn't of that religious background.
They had a very quick conversion to Rastafarianism behind the flashing lights of that cop car.
Exactly. So the system has a safety valve built in there for this, you believe?
It's a case law tested term, sincerely held religious belief. There you have to refer to a consistent pattern of someone exhibiting that practice of religion, as well as there have to be some documented texts or a Bible, for instance, or something equivalent to that for that particular religion. It can't be something, as Dave pointed out, an overnight conversion just for convenience sake.
If a company wanted to make that, and we know we do have court precedents regarding even the private sector and private companies, and they claim religious beliefs, but they have employees who are openly atheist, doesn't that call into question whether that company is has sincerely held religious belief?
Well, there are two situations that took place here in Michigan, a little more locally, that help articulate the reason why something like this is necessary. The first one had to do with a car accident that took place just north of here in Clinton County back in the 1990s. And this was a person who tragically died in a car accident. They were an Orthodox Jewish family, which is opposed to doing autopsies, but the county medical examiner wanted to go ahead to determine the cause of death, which everybody knew was because of the car accident, yet that family was not able to exercise their First Amendment religious liberty rights. Another issue that came forward was back in 2010, there was a woman over in the Grand Rapids area who posted an ad for a roommate in her church looking for a Christian roommate. And somebody was offended by that. They brought it to the attention of the local Department of Civil Rights office, which sent it up to the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development. And this woman was actually investigated by the state and federal government because she was looking for a Christian roommate. Now, after a couple of years of her life going through, what she most likely did not want to go through in dealing with letters and all kinds of investigations from the authorities, they finally realized that it was ridiculous. They dropped the case after she had legal counsel to help her through the process. So those two examples, we think that RFRA would be very important, making sure that people's religious identity is not...
Could have avoided both of those.
It could have been avoided, and it really wouldn't have caused the distress that were brought into those people's lives. So RFRA is actually used very sparingly throughout the country. And I think as we go forward, if this issue does come back up in the legislature, we're looking for the opportunity to help educate the public on why this law is important and regrettably have to address some of the misinformation that's put out there by the opponents.
Death penalty issue has resurfaced again. A bill this time around. We've seen this bill put in the cop killers, death penalty. Your group not budging on this issue, I assume.
Well, the Catholic Church has always been very strong, especially in the past 20 to 30 years or so, against the death penalty, not just for religious or moral reasons, but also it's bad public policy. The death penalty resolution has been introduced now a couple times in the last 10 years. Representative Larry Julian has introduced it on a couple of occasions back in the 1990s and then more recently back in 2004. And there's always been heated debates on the issue.
Sometimes Catholic legislators supporting that.
Yeah, that issue's come up as well. And, you take a look at the reason why we have life in prison without the chance for parole. We think that's a sentence that helps to shield an aggressor from the rest of society so that nobody else is harmed. And really, when you take a look at the death penalty, it's state sanctioned murder, if you can use that phrase. It's the state government deciding who can live and who can die, and we don't believe that the government has either that right or that responsibility. Michigan was the first English speaking jurisdiction to outlaw capital punishment. It was included in the 1963 state constitution. And as I mentioned, there have been a couple efforts to bring it back. They haven't gone very far. The 2004 effort sought to be a petition drive to put it before voters, and that didn't collect the number of petitions that it needed after it didn't make its way through the legislature. So we feel that we do have structures in place, life without the possibility of parole to protect the offender. To prevent the public from the offender. And the resolution was introduced by a state senator from the Detroit area. It doesn't sound as if that is going to be moving forward here this session. I think it was brought forward for a constituent reason. But it's something that we do take a very strong position on, because we believe that either from the beginning of human life or to the end of human life and everything in between, everybody has a right to human dignity. But at the same time, when heinous crimes are committed, that person should be punished. And we do believe that the laws that are in place are adequate to prevent society from aggressors.
Every time you see a story, obviously, when someone is let out of prison because they were found to have been innocent after serving 14 years, that obviously has to help your side of the debate on this.
There have been those situations that have come forward. Senator Rick Jones from the Eaton County area, who's the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, said you can let somebody out of prison, but you can't dig them up out of the ground. And it's one way that you can look at it. And the death penalty as a whole, if you look across the country, most states are moving away from it. They're seeing it as inhumane in many circumstances, where people are sent to die by means of lethal injection. And oftentimes those chemicals don't interact properly. And the person is in agony for a good 45 minutes. That's happened in several situations across the country. And it's prompted the United States Supreme Court to take a look at whether or not lethal injection constitutes cruel and unusual punishment. So we're very pleased that the Supreme Court is taking a look at that. We think the trend is most states in the country in general are moving away from the death penalty. And I think a lot of people have pointed out that that's not the direction that Michigan wants to go.
Immigration is a federal issue, because so often what surfaces regarding the immigration debate is the breaking up of families.
Obviously, our intent is to make sure that families do not get broken up. That's one of the most heart-wrenching things about when you're talking about immigration policy here in the United States. You have folks that are in other countries that you know, have come here. They are here. And they get sent back, and their families get broken up. You know, our interest in Michigan is to make sure that, you know, there are no illegal people. I know, and maybe some of the listeners in your stations probably have maybe a different understanding than everyone else about the importance of immigration as it relates to labor and part of the community and part of the farm labor. So you do have an interesting divide. It can be politically polarizing at times, but the church is always focused on making sure the families are united as best as possible and that humans are treated as dignity. There are no illegal people. They're just, can we get some kind of dignity for people?
Should there be some sort of fast track kind of situation to fix the problem, or should their country have, and right now does have, the policy of deportation? Even though it doesn't seem to be very effective, that's the policy. Should we get rid of that policy?
You know, I don't know that we would say that. I mean, I think there probably are reasons to have that. I think it's naive to think you can deport 12.3 million people overnight. As far as a fast track to a legal status, I don't know that that's the best policy either. But we think that there should be some way that we should, A, protect our borders, make sure that people you know, that want to have visas to work here temporarily can have that and be able to help our economy, but also people that are here and have been here can find some sort of path. Maybe it takes a little bit of time, but have some sort of path and not have to live in the shadows. You know, when they come out of the shadows, you can pay taxes. It really helps with public safety issues, which I might add is another good reason to have a deportation policy. If somebody's violating public safety, well, then that's another story. But if folks are afraid to come out of the shadows, afraid to report a crime, you're going to have more instances of domestic violence, child abuse, other type of crimes that go unreported, including the most heinous of all, human trafficking. People are taken advantage of either for slave-like labor or for sex trafficking, because they're people that are marginalized by society by having to live their life, you know, looking around their shoulder every 2 minutes to make sure nobody's coming after them. And that's not a tenable situation for anybody.
What do you think of the job Governor Rick Snyder's done?
I think he's a good governor. You know, I think he's taken some difficult decisions. You know, our state appears to be on the right track. Obviously we want to work with them. We want to work with everybody in the legislature in both parties. It's important that, as the Catholic Conference, we're not Republican or Democrat. We have to work with folks on every issue, and we're an equal opportunity offender of both parties, depending on what issue we're working on. But we've had a good relationship with the governor and would hope to continue that.
Prop 1 includes restoring the earned income tax credit to the earlier level. And I know your group's been very interested in that issue. But still, you're not taking a position on the proposal, which has obviously a lot of things in it. But you're not doing that.
No, at this point we're not. We have a board meeting coming up, so that could come up as a discussion point. I don't see it because it really is primarily an infrastructure, and we have to look at where we are, our expertise is. Now, with the earned income tax credit, that's certainly something we applauded the legislature at that time for including that. We think that that's a policy that, again, shouldn't be a partisan policy. You're talking about people that are the working poor. They're trying to get ahead, and they're working. It's not a welfare. It's not a handout. It's sort of like I'm on the board of directors for Habitat for Humanity. There are people like to think that we give out free houses. No, that's not it. It's a hand up. EITC is a hand up for folks that maybe they need a couple of extra dollars to help get some groceries, but they're working. They have a job and they're contributing to the community. We're going to take some time probably and educate Catholics throughout the state as to the details of this proposal and hopefully have an opportunity to put a point on that income tax credit as well.
Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us.
Great. Thanks for having us.
Back with a final word in a moment.